Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was co-sponsored by the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project and was recorded on Monday, November 6, 2017, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleform conference call, as today we discuss the administrative state. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups and General Counsel here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to announce this teleforum is co-sponsored with the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project and will be made available as a downloadable podcast on its free lunch podcast series available at regproject.org. There you can learn more about the Regulatory Transparency Project. It's out to review regulations and to identify and raise awareness of where regulations seem to be doing more harm than good, something we might talk about on today's teleform conference call. I'm very pleased to welcome two guests to our call today, two experts. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 10 minutes. We'll hear first from Professor Philip Hamburger. He's the Maurice and Hilda Friedman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. He'll be followed in opening remarks by John Allison. He's executive in residence at Wake Forest School for Business. He's also the former chairman and CEO of BB&T Corporation, and he's on the board of Cato right here in Washington, D.C. With that, Professor Hamburger, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here. So the topic for today focuses on whether rollbacks of administrative rules and regulations will be sufficient, and my thought can be summed up very clearly with the word no. I think we need structural change, and I'd like to talk about why that's so. The problem with the notion of a rollback is that it has an inadequate, it relies on an inadequate conception of the problem. Administrative power is often thought of in economic terms. It's said to be a burden on prosperity, a burden on innovation, on business, and if that's the case, then we just need a less administrative power. We need less burdensome administrative rules. But it's not an objection to the administrative lawmaking and adjudicatory processes themselves. It's an objection, which are simply processes of imposing regulation as opposed to those that come through Congress. And that seems to me, although not wrong, at least not our main problem. The underlying problem is the constitutional one. Administrative power, meaning the power to bind through executive or so-called administrative independent agencies, is unconstitutional. In fact, I'd go further. I'd say it's a profound civil liberties issue. And that means we need a civil rights movement against administrative power. In fact, I'd say it's the most serious civil liberties issue of our era. And, you know, in the past, we've had civil liberties movements to protect the rights of some Americans. This is a civil liberties movement to protect the rights, I think, of all Americans. And if that's the nature of our problem, then what we really need is structural change. We don't just need relief for a season. We need a rejection or abolition of administrative power for all seasons. So what are the constitutional problems? I'd like to focus on one angle, namely the civil liberties angle. It's often said that the constitutional problems involve separation of powers and federalism, and I think those are very important issues. But for all the talk of these issues for nearly a century or so, that hasn't actually impeded the drift, the expansion of the administrative state. And so it seems to be important to focus on what actually matters to all sorts of people, even if they are not businesses, but matters to individuals, and that is the civil liberties aspect of all of this. So let me just run through some examples. Procedural rights. Most of the Bill of Rights consists of various procedural guarantees, and almost all of these can be evaded by the administrative adjudicatory process. Consider jury rights. The Constitution carefully protects our rights to juries, both in civil and criminal cases. And what's the administrative state got to do with this? Well, the administrative state creates an alternative, not civil, not criminal process, an administrative process, and bingo, you don't get your jury rights. You don't get them in court, sorry, in the administrative tribunal, and you don't get them later even in court. Think also of due process rights. The due process of law is an ancient concept, dates back to the 14th century. And due process statutes from the beginning were designed to ensure that one is only proceeded against in the courts, the real courts, not any fake courts, prerogative or administrative. Due process, thus, was a bar against administrative adjudication of any that binds or creates legal obligation. That was true in the 17th century, it was understood in the 18th century. Commentators in the U.S. Constitution from the very beginning, such as St. George Tucker, later James Kent and Joseph Story, all say that due process requires any proceedings against one to be in a court of law with a real judge. Nonetheless, administrative power evades this. And the larger issue is that I think our procedural rights have been transformed. They once were guarantees for individuals or companies against the government. They're no longer guarantees. The government has an ambidextrous way of proceeding against us through the courts or through administrative tribunals. And as a result, our procedural rights are no longer guarantees for people, but rather are modes of power, an alternative mode of power for the government. It can go through the guarantees and, through the courts and thereby give you the guarantees listed in the Bill of Rights, or it can simply not if it doesn't wish to and go through another mechanism. To press home this point about violation of procedural rights, I'd like to talk a little bit about what happens in the courts of law when you appeal. When you appeal from an administrative decision, you end up in the courts, but you even in the courts, you don't get your jury rights, and you don't actually get due process. There's deference by the courts on the facts to the administrative record and deference on the law to the legal interpretations of the agencies through doctrines such as Chevron. And the result is, you know, there are only two issues really in any case, the facts and the law, and on both, there's deference to the government. And of course, where the government is a party to a case, this means bias in favor of the government's legal position. In other words, these deference doctrines are actually a source of systematic bias in the courts, not merely in administrative agencies. So I call Chevron deference Chevron bias, and it's a profound violation of due process. And if the courts persist in this, it will ruin their reputation for justice. They cannot persist in it. But of course, it's not just procedural rights. Let me throw in substantive rights. When the government can proceed against one in administrative proceedings, it can undermine the substantive liberties protected by the Bill of Rights. A good example is free speech. Freedom of speech was initially understood, and freedom of speech in the press was initially understood under the First Amendment as being centrally about a freedom from administrative licensing. Now we have more than a half dozen major agencies that license speech. It's prior administrative licensing of speech. It's difficult to think of something that is a more serious violation of the First Amendment. I'd like to close by talking about something else, not procedural rights, not one's regular substantive rights, but rather about equal voting rights. What has administrative power got to do with equal voting rights? And the answer is, unfortunately, quite a lot. If you think of the two major developments in American law since the Civil War, one, equal voting rights, two, administrative power. And the question is that a coincidence? And I don't think it is. In 1870, blacks get the right to vote. 1920, women get the right to vote. Mid-1960s, blacks really get the right to vote. And what accompanied this was administrative power. Essentially, the knowledge class, after allowing everyone the right to vote, regretted the consequences. And they dealt with this not by abandoning equal voting rights, but by moving legislative power out of the legislature and into the hands of people, well, like themselves. And Woodrow Wilson was quite candid about this. I'll just quote you a little bit. He complained that these are his words, not mine, the reformers bewildered by the need to persuade a voting majority of several million heads. And he adds he's particularly worried about the need to influence the mind not of Americans of the older stocks only, but of Irishmen, of Germans, of Negroes. And he elaborates, the bulk of mankind is rigidly unphilosophical, and nowadays the bulk of mankind votes. And where is this unphilosophical bulk of mankind more multifarious in its composition than the United States? So in order to get a footing for new doctrine, one must influence minds cast in every mold of race, minds inheriting every bias of environment warped by the histories of a score of different nations, warmed or chilled, closed or expanded by almost every climate of the globe. I won't go on reading you this racist tripe, but you get the idea. I don't think administrative law is necessarily racist, but it is incompatible with equal voting rights, and it makes a mockery of equal voting rights, and it interferes with the ability of diverse Americans to secure their interests through a representative system of government. This is profoundly dangerous, and we need to recognize this profound violation of civil liberties by responding appropriately, which means structural change. I should add, just in closing, that I've not only written the subject, but I've started a new civil liberties group, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, to litigate these issues, and we're going to be hiring in the coming months. So if you're interested, don't hesitate to let us know. This is going to have to be more than an organization, however. It's a movement, and we'll all have to contribute. Thank you so much.
John Allison, please go right ahead.
All right. Good afternoon. I really agree very much with what Philip said. I do think we need fundamental structural change. I'm going to approach the subject in a little different perspective in that I'm primarily a business person. And the thing I see that's happened with the administrative state is the fundamental destruction of the rule of law. And that has huge consequences for human well-being, and certainly for economic progress. I'll try to concretize that with a few stories to show that what happens is that Congress passes a lot of sound, good legislation, but the interpretation of that legislation is left open to the administrative state. And the reason Congress does that is they don't want to be responsible for anything that might be negative that would come out of their legislation. So it all sounds good. I'll give you some meat on those bones. When I first became CEO of BB&T, this was back in, I became CEO in 1989, not long thereafter, Bill Clinton gets elected, and Clinton was elected with a lot of vote from the African-American community. And he decided that he wanted to, quote, pay back the African-American community, and his basis of that was to eliminate what he perceived was discrimination in the banking business. It was based on a false study done by the Federal Reserve, which has subsequently been totally discredited. In fact, an embarrassment for the Fed. But Clinton literally gave off orders to the regulators, the banking regulators, to go find banks guilty of discrimination. Well, back in the 60s, probably banks did discriminate. By the time Clinton got elected, banks weren't discriminating. A, it was against the law, and B, it wasn't practical because it was economically disadvantaged not to try to find as many good customers as you can. Anyway, the examiners went across the country, and they were making an interesting deal. They would come into organizations, basically threaten them to find them guilty of discrimination using some really ridiculous tools that were invented for this process, and then offer them a deal. You pay a small fine. You agree to make these process changes, and we, the government, gets to make some announcement. We found somebody guilty of discrimination, and we're fixing this problem. And they were systematically doing this, and a number of banks, quote, pled guilty. When they came into BB&T, they tried to do the same thing to us. But we knew we didn't discriminate based on race. A lot of our markets are, at that time, were actually minority-dominated markets. We couldn't even stay in business based on that criterion. So we refused to play the game. And we got into a fight with them. Their arguments were ridiculous, and they really didn't want to go to court because they would look ridiculous in court. But what they did to us, they stopped all our mergers and acquisitions. They stopped us opening new branches. We had to hire outside consultants. A lot of our team was working 7 days a week to get information. And the more we studied, the more ridiculous their claims were. But they were going to just beat us down through the process because – the recourse to the legal system, they first had to find us guilty of something. They could stop us for years, literally, from acting before we ever even got to the court system. In any event, a couple years in, there was a big swing back to the Republicans. Those of you in my age group will remember. And that election happened on Tuesday. The Republicans swept the congressional elections on a Tuesday. On Thursday, all the regulators went home, and they never pursued this supposed discrimination because Bill Clinton told them not to do that. So the law had effectively changed twice. A, he had invented the law through his administrative state, and then he had reversed the law through the administrative state. We went through the same kind of process in regards to the recent financial crisis, where there was intense pressure on banks to do what was called affordable housing lending, now subprime lending. And then as soon as the financial crisis happened, if you'd done affordable housing lending, you were evil and under intense scrutiny. Under the Bush administration, because the economy was doing well and there were very low charge-offs, and Bush got so excited by September 11th, they basically gutted the safety and soundness side of the banking business and hired an army of people on the compliance side focused on the Patriot Act and particularly on what's called the Bank Secrecy Act, which is an old law where we're supposed to identify fraud cases. And, of course, this got focused on terrorism. And they changed the standards by which you had to identify so-called problems to become almost ridiculous, so that we had to put in what's called suspicious activity reports for activity that nobody objectively would consider suspicious. It was effectively a major change in the law done through the administrative state. It makes it very hard to manage businesses when you don't know what the law is. In the recent financial crisis, the Federal Reserve asserted numerous powers that it never had been statutorily given. And its actions, in fact, created the crisis. It didn't create the correction, and I'll differentiate the crisis from the correction. The crisis was the fact that there was so much ambiguity because the rule of law had basically gone away. You know, they save Citigroup, but they force Wachovia out of business. They save Bear Stearns. They force Lehman Brothers out of business. All the rules were subject to the Federal Reserve just kind of made them up as they were going along, and they did that because of their enormous administrative power. So the administrative state is very dangerous. It is influenced by political processes, but it runs independently based on its own goals and objectives. And while in the Clinton story was actually a little bit of a rollback of the administrative state, in general, the administrative state consistently advances because government bureaucrats like power. They are power lusters. They like to be in charge, and they get more staff, and they get more money, and they get more power when they advance the state. So it's very easy for an Obama to expand the administrative state, which is exactly what happened certainly in the banking industry, but you look at the EPA and regulations across the board. For whatever foibles he has, Trump has at least tried to roll some of these regulations back, and he's had some success, but he'll never get them back to zero because there will be huge resistance by the bureaucracies themselves. It takes their power away. It takes their control away, and that is not what they want. They want more power and more control. And so it's kind of one of those two steps forward, maybe one step back, maybe one and a half steps back, but always moving towards more and more power. And you can look at the role of the government bureaucracies and how they've expanded exponentially. And it is an exponential expansion. If you look at the size and the scope of the regulatory state, it's growing, and it's growing very, very rapidly. I think it poses a huge challenge to the whole idea of constitutional law, a huge challenge to Republican governments, because while these bureaucrats are in the short term influenced by the political process, in the long term they have their own agendas, and their own agendas are about expanding their power and their control. And it's a very difficult process to do anything about. And if you're a business, it is almost impossible to fight your regulators. You might win in court, but it'll be 5 years down the road, and you'll be out of business. And they can put basically any business out of business they want to. In the banking industry, again, there's a law called the Privacy Act and there's the Patriot Act, which are actually in direct contradiction with each other. You can't really comply fully with both of those laws. The administrative state loves that kind of regulation because they can choose what to interpret and they can make it practically impossible for you to fight them. This whole the issue that was brought up about the belief that the government bureaucracy is right, and in case we're putting the burden of proof on a business, for example, or an individual to prove the bureaucrats are wrong, is kind of fundamentally opposite of the whole concept of innocence. Because usually what the bureaucracy is doing is imposing some kind of penalty, which is almost like a criminal penalty, on an organization or an individual, and that individual has to prove that they're wrong to do that, which is an inversion of the whole concept of innocent until proven guilty. So I think the administrative state is maybe our biggest issue, more than our political situation, and I think it's a huge challenge. I love Philip's idea of structural change, how to get it implemented. I'm not sure. So, Dean, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's open the floor to questions before we enter into discussion of our own. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or both of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll turn to your questions in just a moment. Before we do that, I wanted to ask of Professor Hamburger, you mentioned the name of your new organization that you're hiring. How do people find your organization online? Is there a website?
Right. There is a website established mostly for hiring purposes, and it's at ncla.legal. If you just type that in, it will take you to the website. And on the website, one can apply for the
NCLA.legal.
For the new Civil Liberties Alliance.
Great. Very good. Once again, if you have a question in the audience and you'd like to pose it to one or both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Maybe I can get us started. If you're in the audience and you think, boy, somebody should write a book on this, it's been written by Philip Hamburger. Administrative law is unlawful.
Oh, but we need more books on the subject, so please do write.
Yeah.
Better written books than mine.
I'm not trying to discourage additional scholarship, but so it does raise the question, if this is all run off the rails and if institutional changes are needed, structural changes, rather than a rollback, which has been described as useful but insufficient, how do we get to those structural changes? Are there some concrete things that can be done? I mean, it feels to me like it's taken us 120 years to get here. It's a long road back, but I ask that question of either of our experts.
Well, I'll have a shot at it. This is Philip Hamburger.
Yes.
The answer isn't obvious, but some answers, I think, are obviously the wrong tack. So one could rely on Congress. I confess I don't have great hopes for that. Perhaps Congress will reform itself and then take a shot at the administrative state. So one can always hold out a little bit of hope, but Congress is an improbable mover in all of this for a host of obvious reasons. Another possibility, of course, is the executive branch. There is, I think, some hope that the current administration will do something about about administrative power. But thus far, they've only rolled back regulations. They haven't made structural changes. I'm sure that some members of the administration do understand that structural change is necessary, but whether they will get around to doing that, who knows? They have many things on their plate. And that leads then to a third possibility, which is through the courts and more generally through a civil liberties movement. I think there is some real hope for the courts. The courts have given us this problem in a sense. They've given us Chevron and all the deference doctrines. They've turned a blind eye to the constitutional violations. But the judges tend to be very principled men and women, individuals with a great commitment to their task as judges. And so there's a real opportunity to appeal to them as judges to consider whether or not administrative power is entirely consistent with their role. And that includes the question of independent judgment, which has already found its way expressed in the Supreme Court, and the question of bias and all the deference doctrines. There are a host of issues which give one good grounds to appeal to the judges on principles that they take very seriously. So that gives me some hope, and I think that's where the anti-administrative movement has to go.
Seeing this as John, I would also agree that the courts are the best short-term option, and the reason that I would have some optimism, I think, is one of the few things that I think Trump's going to do that really matters is with the Supreme Court. He's already done what I think made a great decision, and I think he may have another opportunity or two. But I'm not an attorney, but I can read the Constitution, and most of what the administrative state does is blatantly unconstitutional. You don't have to be an attorney to figure it out. You can just read the Constitution and say, where does that fit? And you know, that whole fact at least exposes the administrative state when it's destructive. And the court systems seems like to me have been not willing to deal with a lot of blatantly unconstitutional issues. But where we can show that the administrative state has really done a lot of damage, and I think that's fairly easy to do, then maybe the courts will get some courage to do what they obviously have the power to do and to say, hey, this is not constitutional. So I do think it's a philosophic fight over ideas and the rule of law, why I got involved with Cato, which is, you know, the world's leading libertarian think tank. That's where some of the fight has to take place, because we're losing a lot of this fight, frankly, and I'm in a university today, and you see it outside of the economics department, the business school. Universities are so far left and so pro-expanded government, they're not very interested in the rule of law or the Constitution. So we have to take the ideas in the universities and even younger ages and fight for those ideas, because I think, except for eliminating the obvious abuses to get real structural change, we not only have to reframe the argument, but we have to reframe the argument at a deeper philosophical level, because that's where we are losing the fight today.
We have a couple. We had a couple callers with questions, but they seem to have dropped off. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Those are some interesting points. I myself gave a talk on some of these issues at Federalist Society chapters, but also in my niece's high school. And I was asked the question on the separation of powers I was talking about, asked the question, what would you change about the Constitution? And to your point, John Ellison, the best answer I could come up with was maybe sprinkle in some exclamation points, because it all seems to be there already. Professor Hamburger, I take it you would agree on that level that
yes, I actually,
the structure if followed, if the Constitution's followed, it's all there.
Right. We have a Constitution. Maybe we should try following it for a few years to see what would happen. It would be a novel experiment. I can't help thinking many people that it's a pity many people want to change the Constitution, have a constitutional convention. If we are to have a constitutional amendment, I confess my choice would be for a one-word amendment. It would run as follows: really, period. And it's like your exclamation marks. I think actually just an exclamation mark would be even more concise, wouldn't it? It's not that hard to figure out. It's easy to twist into other meanings, but it's pretty straightforward. So why don't we just try enacting laws in Congress? You know, we could do it even agency by agency. Trump could, if he wished, I don't think, you know, if it'll do this, but any president could order an agency one a month to present its regulations to Congress and for adoption by Congress. It wouldn't be that difficult. Congress doesn't face all the impediments of the Administrative Procedure Act. It could actually work quicker. Of course, the impediments are political, and that's the whole point of the administrative state. It's to avoid accountability to the people. And that gets back to the voting rights problem. We agonize over every violation of equal voting rights, as we should be concerned about it. But at the same time, we shut our eyes to the fact that legislative power has been largely removed from the control of the people in their elected legislature, so it can be exercised by people who are largely white men and certainly members of the knowledge class. This is very strange, and it's very worrisome. The reality is that with increasing homogenization that comes through the federal government and its control, there's all the more reason to worry about abandoning the political system that's designed to be sensitive to the needs of different Americans of different backgrounds. And that's exactly what the administrative state does not do. It imposes law from above without that accountability that the Constitution establishes, and rightly so.
On purpose.
On purpose. Oh, yes. It's all about cutting off different voices.
Right. We do have one caller with a question now. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Yes, I'd like, if you would, to hear your thoughts with relation to the criminal forfeiture laws and Attorney General Sessions' attitudes towards that. It's then with the some of the things that you're discussing now.
I will react to that. This is John. Having been in the banking business and seeing the incredible abuse of those kind of laws, I think that they're terrible. To be able to take somebody's property when they haven't been charged with a crime, in many cases are never charged with a crime, it's unbelievable. In fact, they can take property that's basically been stolen. We had a case in the banking business. We had one of our customers who had his airplane stolen. The plane was stolen. It was found, somebody carrying drugs. They compensated the airplane, and it took him like 5 years to get it back. And by the time he got it back, it had been terribly taken care of. It's a blatant abuse of police power and the protection of individual rights and property rights. And of course, since the money is going to the police, what a terrible incentive system. I don't think you could design a worse incentive system. Typically what they do, the airplane case was a little different in that that individual did have some financial well-being. Typically, they go after people that are kind of marginal, and they take what little property they have left, they don't really have the resources to get it back, by the time they get it back, the cost of getting it back has exceeded the value of what's been taken. I think Sessions is totally wrong, and I think it's really bad law.
It's funny you mentioned the airplane case. Something very much like that happened to me. But I confess, I don't own an airplane. I had a 17-year-old American car, which I much loved. And when it was stolen, I confess, I had mixed feelings. I was sorry about the loss of the car, but I was somewhat flattered that anyone actually wanted it. The difficulty came when the car was recovered and I couldn't get it back because the state of Illinois had its hands on it. Right, so this is a very serious problem. If you think about the nature of administrative power, it's ultimately an evasion of the pathways for lawmaking and adjudication set out in the Constitution. And this evasion runs deep. It's not just an evasion of the constitutional, that's the first step. Once we had the APA, then we get all sorts of administrative evasions of the APA and the regular modes of administrative power. Even those are too constraining for the administrative state. And so when one looks at forfeitures, it's quite easy to see that this is an evasion of the ordinary means of imposing criminal penalties and an evasion of the ordinary means of taking property, right? And whether one views it in the one point of view as a criminal penalty or another point of view as a taking, it denies one's due process that one should get in court. If your properties can be taken, it shouldn't be done this way. Now, there are all sorts of excuses that are created. It's said to be an in rem proceeding and notice is given and so forth. But from that one, for the marginal case of abandoned property to this system, which is really a means of confiscating property that is used in any connection with any criminal investigation, even if one's not found guilty and even if you're not the criminal, and the government candidly concedes you're not the criminal, it's turned into a very dangerous program. And it's doubly bad, of course, because very often the same police agencies that engage in grabbing forfeitures enrich themselves thereby. And this creates a serious due process problem it creates an appearance of corruption, an actual corruption, because of course these agencies are affected by their sense of whether or not they get to keep the property. No agency should be able to keep that which it secures through its, I don't want to call it due process, through its faux process. The faux process shouldn't exist in the first place, and they certainly shouldn't keep the ill-gotten gains from their ill-conceived proceedings.
My screen is lighting up here with questions from the audience, so let's head in a new direction with a new caller.
Good afternoon, John and Philip. This discussion, I have to tell you, is balm for my soul. I've been concerned about the extension of the regulatory state for a long time. I just want to give you another example, though, which is the HIPAA regulations, the regulations for a minimum standard of medical privacy that were enacted by the Department of Health and Human Services. This was the subject of debate in Congress for a long time, and Congress eventually just punted on this and said, if we don't act on this by a certain date, we hereby delegate the Department of Health and Human Services to issue regulations governing minimum standards for medical confidentiality. And they enacted these sweeping regulations that actually supersede state laws. If the state law standard of medical confidentiality is lower than the standard of the HIPAA regulations. And to me, I could never understand how that would be constitutional, but apparently it was challenged in federal court, and the federal courts upheld the legality of the regulations. But to me, that is just so constitutionally offensive that I don't know how it could have been done.
Can I have a shot at this? This is Philip. So I agree with you. These are very, very dangerous regulations, and there are layers of issues. One of them is the federalism issue you mentioned, that administrative regulation should trump state law is extraordinary, and yet it's considered quite normal these days. If one looks at the Supremacy Clause, it's drafted to say that laws made in pursuance of the Constitution can trump state law. That's what the main part of the supreme law of the land. And as Brad Clark, GW, has pointed out, that actually places a process limitation on what's part of the supreme law of the land, laws made in pursuance of the Constitution. Administrative rules are made in pursuance of statute. They're not made in pursuance of the Constitution. And so, as Brad points out, they don't trump, according to the Supremacy Clause, they don't trump state law. But the Supreme Court seems to have forgotten all of this. Then there's a second issue with the HIPAA regs, and something I've been particularly involved in. I'm very much interested in the regulation of science. There's a series of regulations coming out of HHS, the HIPAA privacy regulations and the human subjects research regulations, that establish prior administrative licensing of words. To transfer supposedly private medical information from one person to another, even among doctors or among researchers, requires the permission of an institutional review board or a privacy board. And then that result is that these boards censor the transmission of words. Like the human subjects research regulations, which also establish licensing of medical acquisition of medical knowledge and its publication, there's a profoundly high cost in human life. The HHS regulations on human subjects, not even including the privacy rules under HIPAA, have almost certainly have a death rate well beyond that of American losses in Vietnam, because when you suppress medical information, you can show that people die. I won't bore you with all the details on this, but there's a vast death toll attributable to these regulations.
We've got three callers with questions now, so let's carry on. Caller, if you have your own telephone on mute, we're unable to hear you calling from 202-340. If you unmute your phone.
Sorry about that. This is Joe DeSantis. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in D.C. Hi, Dean. Hope you're doing well. This is a great show and a session. I appreciate both of you joining. I agree completely that injecting the congressional accountability back into the process would be a great idea. On the other end, however, we still would have an army of bureaucrats who are resistant to implementing whatever proper adjustments Congress might make to the accountability standards or the accountability or the, you know, the implementation of these things. What's your suggestion or thoughts on how to better, and as you know, probably it's difficult, if not impossible, to actually remove intransigent or insubordinate bureaucrats as a practical matter. What are your thoughts about how to handle on the agency end in terms of limiting what Congress rightfully takes control over to the process?
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, in terms of one of the first steps would be to be able to fire government bureaucrats just like a business can fire employees. It's ridiculous to me, the protection that government bureaucrats have. You know, this probably older than this group, there was a large insurance agency for savings and loans called the FSLIC. They did a terrible job when the savings and loan industry collapsed in the early 90s, and taxpayers lost hundreds of millions of dollars. You know what happened to the employees of all? They're all government employees. The insurance, the FSLIC was a government agency. They all ended up working for the FDIC. So, I mean, it's almost impossible for a government employee to get fired. And that, of course you can't facilitate change if you can't fire people. I don't know what the logic is in not being able to do that.
So the logic, surely to protect them from the political process, which is exactly why, of course, we have elected lawmakers so we can fire them. It is pathetic, isn't it? I can't help thinking that a president, were he or she inclined, could do something about this. One need only collect the names of a few government employees who spend their days, gambling, looking at pornography, or doing other ill-advised acts, and simply fire them, and fire them directly without going through the most difficult process that's currently in place. And then let them be challenged, let it be challenged constitutionally and see what happens. I think a president could address this if he or she had enough gumption. As for government employees, though, I confess I disagree slightly with the caller, though I much respect his opinions. It's not clear to me that we need to get rid of government agencies. Frankly, I'd be quite happy to pay every government official twice what they now earn if they would desist from issuing binding regulations. One solution may be to get rid of the unneeded government employees, but many do have expertise. There's no reason they shouldn't share that with Congress. And regardless, it isn't really about them personally. I know they're expensive, but frankly, it's the system of lawmaking outside Congress and adjudication outside the courts that's really expensive. So if necessary, I would gladly support paying them extra to desist from unconstitutional acts.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Two questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Chris Garvey. I'm a Libertarian candidate for Suffolk County District Attorney up here in New York for election tomorrow. My predecessor actually was paying a civil asset forfeiture proceed bonuses to his assistant DAs. He's been indicted for other purposes, for other reasons, but it's quite a blatant example of a civil asset forfeiture problem. But you mentioned that the HIPAA is reducing the amount of medical information. For a long time, I had been able to say that something like 99% of all the mass murderers were on some sort of selective serotonin uptake inhibitor like Zoloft. And the most recent ones their blood tests have not been released. And I wonder if that's one of the artifacts of HIPAA.
That's a very interesting question. I don't know the answer. The death toll from HIPAA is interesting because it comes in two forms. Most immediately, there are patients who, if they fail to be able to, cannot get their medical information transmitted in ways that allow their doctors to treat them in a way that's best for their recovery. And that happens when their HIPAA forms are either misdrafted or can't be found and the like, or there's just slowness in the bureaucracy. Even more seriously, of course, there are impediments to research, and that has even higher cost.
Mm-hmm. And that's despite the fact that under Obamacare, every single ailment has its own special code number.
Right. Well, so we can debate the substance of policy. I'm not sure we should go down that road, but and I want to emphasize, I don't think Obama was much worse than many Republicans. I think this has been we probably all agree, this is there's an equal opportunity abuse from both Democrats and Republicans. What's worrisome about all the coding is that, of course, diseases don't always fall neatly into the boxes created by government bureaucrats. And that has, so the mere coding also has certain consequences in reifying our problems.
A little aside, I went to the doctor this morning. I had to sign four little pads, one of these electronic pads, and they would just tell me what's in the pad, like HIPAA. And I think what's happened in another way, because of all these rules and regulations, nobody pays any attention to what might matter, what might be of substance. When I started in the banking business, you can make a loan with three pieces of paper. Today, if you go get a mortgage loan, you get hundreds of pieces of paper. And my observation, on those three pieces of paper, you actually knew what you were agreeing to do. Now most people sign these forms and don't really know what they're agreeing to do. And I think that same thing goes across the board with this massive amount of paper that comes out of these bureaucracies, which to some degree creates jobs for them. The more paper, the more jobs, the more violations of the paper. So it's a kind of a self-defeating machine.
Well, it's also an old litigation strategy. When you're during discovery, when you're forced to produce documents, instead of producing just the three vital documents, you give them truckloads and let them try and find the three vital documents among the truck. But Professor Hamburger, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say there's a very good book that came out a year or two ago by Carl Schneider at Michigan and Omer Ben-Shachar on the consent forms and how little they're regarded and how useless they are. But, of course, they put it in more sophisticated ways than I can do.
When the Privacy Act was passed for the banking business, we bought a lot of community banks. One of the community banks we bought told me this story. When the law was passed, you had to send this form about your protections under this act. And this bank sent it to all their several thousand customers. And in the last paragraph, they said, if you bring this form in, we'll give you $100. They only had one person that brought the form in and got the $100. I mean, do any of you guys read those forms, even attorneys? I don't. I thought that was humorous.
Well, of course, every government document has an extra page in it to tell you about the Paperwork Reduction Act.
Right.
Let's check in with another caller now, if we could. Again, if you're like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 12 minutes left, two callers. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Dean. It's Craig Heimowitz. I was going to follow up on a point before about the problem with the civil service. I mean, obviously, it'd be very hard to get rid of all these people without a fundamental change in the civil service rules. And, you know, it seems like something Trump could pick up and run with if he wanted to, as far as on the drain the swamp theory. And I'm wondering whether anyone's heard that might be in the pipeline somewhere after health care and tax cuts and defeating North Korea and all the other minor stuff.
I haven't got a clue.
I have not heard anything either. I don't know how much of it's just is executive branch or how much of it's actually in laws. I don't know the separation between the two. But it would be a great idea. I think it would be something that people would enthusiastically support, the average Joe. So it'd be a good item for him to pick up.
Yeah, I mean, I think if GAO doesn't have a report, you commission one that shows that, you know, the average government worker is out on workers' comp at least X percentage of every year, and they only work so many actual days per year. I think it'd be pretty scandalous from my brief working with the federal government. Go ahead.
I'd like to emphasize that we really have two different issues here, though. The civil service reform is important, and the current administration may have an interest in that or not, I don't know. whatever they did, and if they couldn't get Congress on board, they'd have to do with some moderation and sophistication, because they have to make constitutional arguments of a sort that haven't been pursued for a long time. And then there's another question, which is the power of the agencies to make binding rules and determinations, and that's the administrative law question. I must say that if they were going to deal with just one of these issues, I'd rather they dealt with the administrative power question rather than the civil service question, because, as I said earlier, it would be a small price to pay to double the salary of all these ladies and gentlemen, whether they're doing a good job as some do or a bad job as some others do, if we could get rid of the administrative power.
I would agree with that, Phil, but I would add this argument. If we're not going to do that, and I'm skeptical we are going to do something about it. I wish we would, and I hope you're successful. But just letting bureaucrats know they could be fired would make them much less aggressive, practically speaking, in terms of expanding regulations. The way it works now, it's a one-sided bet. They expand regulations, they get bigger staff, they get promoted, they get more money, they get more power. And if the regulation is destructive, there are no negative consequences for them. And I don't mean fraud and stuff. I mean just a business can't fight back against a destructive regulation or something that's obviously economically destructive. And if they do fight back and finally win, nothing happens to the government bureaucrats that implemented that policy. So
I could add to that, I'd like to echo that, because it seems to me a key issue here is qualified immunity. The reality is that government bureaucrats, even those who have plenty of time to consult a lawyer, government lawyer, are protected by qualified immunity from suit. And the traditional solution we had to unconstitutional acts was to sue government officers for damages, and they didn't get qualified immunity. So part of the civil liberties movement here, I think, has to be to reexamine qualified immunity, at least for those who can consult a lawyer. There's no reason they should have qualified immunity, because as it stands, they can violate the law without really worrying about being held to account. And it really has to cut the other way, as it did in the past, namely that they would be anxious to stay within the law lest they be sued for damages.
Well, I use the example. The Federal Reserve radically expanded its powers during the financial crisis, in my view, completely illegally. And one reason I think they were willing to do that, there was no downside risk to them. They could not be punished for violating the law. Their own, in many cases, their own regulations, they couldn't be punished for doing that. And that, I think, gives them too much power to do too much damage.
Well, we've got about 8 minutes left, one question pending, so let's check in with what might be our final caller.
Thank you. My name is Richard. I'm also a lawyer, 73 years old. I agree with the speakers about the magnitude of the problem, that the administrative state is largely in violation of our Constitution. I have little hope that Washington is going to rectify the problem, that Congress is going to do anything about it. I'm just about as skeptical that we can make much progress through the courts. I've spent a small fortune on politicians who said that they were going to ensure that we had the appointment of judges who would rein in the administrative state and other judicial excesses. Although I realize it's a long shot, I'm looking at the Convention of the States as the only feasible, possible solution to reining in the administrative state. I realize the skepticism on the part of lawyers and law professors, but Article 5 has provided for this vehicle in the event that Washington went far off the rails and beyond its constitutional authority. So I would suggest that we lawyers who are, and professors who are concerned about the administrative state at least take a look at what the promoters of the Convention of the States are saying.
This is Philip. I think it's an interesting suggestion, but I confess I can't agree. I think you're right. It's a mistake to spend money on politicians and expect them to reform anything. I think that was a bad investment. On the other hand, it strikes me that pursuing a convention of the states is simultaneously improbable and undesirable. Improbable because There are many of us who are still attached to our Constitution, and undesirable because you have no idea how it will actually be drafted. And if you think it's going to be better drafted by us than it was by the folks who drafted our Constitution, I simply invite you to look at contemporary political theory and legal theory and reconsider. As for litigation and the New Civil Liberties Alliance, we're actually looking forward to this. I think we're going to have fun. There are, in fact, extraordinary incongruities, inconsistencies between the judges' vision of themselves and what they do in administrative cases. And that is an opportunity to bring it to the judges. I'll just give you one example where we're already seeing movement, and that's Chevron deference. The Supreme Court clearly has had this on its mind already since 2014. That's not an accident. Some of us were writing on the subject and saying it's Chevron bias and it violates independent judgment of the judges. And the judges then began to worry about it. I don't think there's a majority on the Supreme Court to get rid of it yet, but they know it's an issue. They know it's exceedingly problematic, and they're just going to wait it out for the moment. But the lower court judges are acting. Judge Gorsuch, right, realized that there's a problem and said as much in opinion. I also encourage you to read the concurring opinion of Judge Jordan on the Third Circuit in Egan versus Delaware River Port Authority. Lower court judges are quite aware of this issue, and as their sentiments filter up, you know, we think Supreme Court corrects errors below, but lower court judges also correct errors from above, come from above, and that process is working. So I think we are going to have a civil liberties movement that, as I said, will be very amusing and worthwhile. We are going to win, and it's going to be fun.
Well, I appreciate your optimism and your idealism, but I've watched this process for too many years to have a whole lot of hope that the judicial system is going to roll back or correct what has taken years to accomplish. And I think your opinion presupposes that the majority of judges have your view of the administrative state. And there's such a diversity and not only in a political outlook or constitutional outlook, but also in ability among the hundreds of judges. And many of them, I don't think, would agree with you.
Right. I very much respect your opinion on this, though I would add two things. One doesn't have to win all judges.
No, I understand.
Just needs to find a few who understand or are willing to do their job. Heroic as it may sound, I think we have some of those judges. And second, for the last century, administrative power has been fought on the wrong grounds. It's been fought on the ground that it's burdensome to business and on separation of powers grounds and federalism grounds. Instead, it has to be understood as a civil liberties issue. That's something all Americans, I think, can understand. So although I'm not naturally an optimist, I don't think my judgment's off on this, but we'll see.
Well, I hope you're not off on it.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, we've been through, covered a lot of territory, and I think answered all the questions of the audience. I don't see any questions pending. I want to thank you both for joining us today. This has been a fantastic discussion, and I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in. A reminder to our audience to monitor the website and check your emails for our next scheduled Teleform conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.